President's Day was a big deal. Back then, we called it Washington's birthday or Lincoln's birthday. But we can't do that anymore because, as you know, Washington and Lincoln are horrible racists or something like that. I'm not sure. I haven't kept up with all the websites that track this sort of thing. But what I do know is that it is President's Day, that it is a holiday, and that it would be silly for me to not celebrate it along with the rest of America. And so that's what I'm doing. I hope we can all get together and just love on President's Day. That's what I'm hoping in the years to come, that President's Day will be just a day of love. It'll be like Valentine's Day, which we just celebrated yesterday, but with even more love. I don't know how that can be, but we're going to give it a go, okay? All right, so we've done some best of segments, some of our favorite stuff from the last few weeks, and I hope you enjoy this very special President's Day edition of the Dory Monson Show. One of the most talked about measures in this legislative session in Olympia is what's being called a wealth tax. It would hit billionaires, and primarily it would hit four billionaires in our state. Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, Steve Ballmer, and Mackenzie Scott, Jeff Bezos' ex. And it's a whopper. But it's getting some traction down in Olympia. One of the main sponsors of the bill is Representative Noelle Frame, who joins us here on the Dory Monson Show. Representative, I appreciate you coming on with me today.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so it would exempt $1 billion of net wealth and then a 1% tax above that. So roughly, Bill Gates would have to write a check for almost $2 billion to our state treasury. Tell me how and why that makes sense.
That would actually be about half of that. And actually, I wanted to say the revenue estimates from our department actually have this affecting approximately 100 taxpayers, not just four. The revenue estimates are that it would generate $2.5 billion per year and affecting approximately 100 taxpayers. And so I know a lot of folks are looking at that Forbes 400 list and trying to figure it out, but based on confidential taxpayer data, the Federal Reserve, and proprietary data from Forbes, the revenue estimates are there. So it's a little bit different, I think, in terms of the numbers and counts that people are assuming based on publicly available information.
Okay, so why is this needed? You already have 9% more in revenues this year than you had last year. Even though we have the pandemic and economic calamity, you have record revenues for all of you in Olympia to spend. Why in the world do you need billions more even?
You got it. So the question I pose back is like, sure, we are bouncing back from the pandemic, which is great, because when the pandemic hit, we are heavily dependent on sales tax, and that first revenue estimate post-COVID had an $8 billion deficit. So it's great news that we are recovering. But my question is, recovering on the backs of whom, right? We have a tax code that has disproportionately depends on low and middle income families and small startup and low margin businesses. So it's great that we're recovering, but we're doing it on the backs of those low and middle income families and those small startup and low margin businesses. And so this measure is really about having a better tool in the toolbox for our tax code that's not so reliant on those heavily regressive taxes. So I see this as part of comprehensive structural tax reform, and again, as a tool in the toolbox to help right the wrongs of the code that we have today.
Okay, but here's the problem with that. I don't know if your bill calls for specifically cutting taxes for other people, but it doesn't really matter because Bill Gates and Steve Ballmer and Jeff Bezos, they're going to leave Washington. If you want them to write a $1 billion check every single year, and you know, no offense to those of you who work in the legislature, but why would they want to turn over $1 billion to one of the most inefficient of enterprises? And that's our state government.
Yeah, Dory. And I just, you know, I push back. I think it's a really cynical view of the world. When you look at something, I mean, you call out Bill Gates specifically, right, in your statement. Bill Gates is deeply, invested in this community. Mm-hmm. He has pledged to give away his wealth, mm-hmm. $1 billion relative to $111 billion of wealth, frankly, isn't asking that much. And it's asking us to have equitable sharing of responsibility of community investments. If we can charge 1% plus tax on real property, and real property is, you know, like somebody's own home, which is a primary tool of wealth building for the middle class. If we can ask the middle class to pay a 1% tax on their key asset of wealth building when they own it, and to pay a tax when they sell it, why would we have 0% tax on financial intangible assets when they own it and 0% tax when they sell it? It's inequitable, and the point of this legislation is to bring parity and equity to the code. And I see somebody like Mr. Gates and his father who have long been advocates for progressive tax reform in the state. So I just firmly reject the assertion that these folks would just leave the state. To the contrary, they are deeply invested in Washington.
Well, then why don't they just willingly? Because, I mean, you say, I have great admiration for the Gates Foundation, but they are so diligent in how they target their giving. And one of the things that they mandate is efficiency and results. And, you know, again, no offense, but that's not our Washington State legislature. Nobody could say that our legislature is efficient and is getting results. I was born here, Representative. You know, we've doubled the state budget in the 8 years that Jay Inslee has been governor. Doubled it in 8 years, and things have never been worse around here when it comes to crime, when it comes to homelessness, to drug addiction. The more we spend, the worse everything gets. And that's why Bill Gates isn't willingly writing checks to the Washington State Treasury, because we're not getting the job done. It's very inefficient. We're not delivering.
So, Dory, got a whole bunch of things to say in response to that. I, too, sure, was born here in Washington State. I grew up in rural Clark County in a part of the state that, frankly, is not terribly favorable to taxes. And
I know it well. My wife is from Clark County.
There you go.
Okay.
And my origin story, honestly, and my interest in politics derives from the inequitable tax structure when in the 90s, we as a state were not upholding our paramount duty and not providing for public education. And that's really what spurred me to get involved, because my schools, you know, wasn't properly funded. So I hear you, you know, as a Washington state. But here, there's just a few things that I'll say. Philanthropy is really important. It is. And we are very grateful for the work of the Gates Foundation. But philanthropy does not replace the core functions of government. And again, what I'm talking about is trying to have equity and parity in how we fund those investments. So again, you know, like we fund the common schools with property tax. And right now, that is all about real property and some degree of personal property. This is about right. parity and all those. So that's one thing in all of this. I will just say, you know, you say like this doesn't specifically, you know, it's not paired with, you know, reforms. But here's the thing, Dory, I'm the chair of the finance committee. I designed the agenda for the meeting, and it was no accident that yesterday, that we had a hearing for the Working Families Tax Credit, the same time. That is, very intentional to tell the story about one of the ways you could. So in House Bill 1406, we talk about some of the revenue generated could create credits against tax paid. There's a very good idea floating out there. It's a bipartisan proposal for the Working Families Tax Credit, House Bill 1297. I didn't need to put that in my bill. It's already
there. We have such limited time. I understand your point. But you're not going to be able to cut those other taxes, because you're not going to get revenues from this one. They will move, and the proof of that is what has happened in Europe, where in the 90s they had a mania about a wealth tax, and they only did it on millionaires. And what they found out was the millionaires all fled the countries that had a wealth tax. Macron in France repealed theirs 2 years ago because it was such an absolute failure, and it drove people out of the country. And in our state, when all of the people we're talking about already have homes in other states, there's no way they're going to stay in this state for the 30 days required so that they can give $1 billion. And then back to my main point. Don't you guys have enough money? You have 9% more this year than you had last year. Why do you need even more?
And Dori, I already answered that question. This is about how we collect revenue and from whom. I am deeply committed to structural tax reform. Another hat that I wear is I'm the co-chair of the tax structure work group. I really encourage folks to go check this out. The website is taxworkgroup.org. We just completed 18 months of economic analysis, and part of that is looking at finally, maybe, replacing the business and occupation tax with something that is better, because it is universally hated. It is a gross receipts tax. It's extraordinarily
aggressive. I agree with you on that.
Yeah, so a lot of people do, but nobody's ever buckled down to do the work. And so, Dori, you know, I don't know how much you know me or tracked my work, but like, if you just go take a look at that work, you will understand that when I am introducing House Bill 1406, when I say it is a potential tool in the toolbox, I'm talking about a major revenue replacement alternative to help us right the wrongs of the tax code, which is the most regressive in the nation. As I said, has low-income households paying six times more in taxes as a share of their income when compared to the highest-earning households. And you have a business and occupation tax that stifles innovation, stifles small business, and makes it very difficult for anybody other than the largest corporations to survive.
I also understand that what you and your party desperately want is an income tax. Whether you call it a capital gains tax or whatever, it is an income tax. It is unconstitutional. And when you talk about how resilient we have been in light of a pandemic and economic calamity, one of the reasons that our state has been resilient, the states without an income tax are the ones that have bounced back the strongest. And Jay Inslee goes on the campaign trail for president talking about our state economy. And one of the reasons our state economy is resilient is because of an income tax. And your party, it's your holy grail to impose an income tax when it's constitutionally prohibited in our state.
Dori, can you explain your constitutional argument to me really quick, just for your listeners so they understand why you think it is unconstitutional? This is just, I mean, helpful for me to understand.
No, you know exactly why it's unconstitutional, because you want a graduated income tax. There is no state, if you're talking about the capital gains tax, there is no state without an income tax that has a capital gains tax, because the IRS has defined capital gains as income. Our state constitution says the only way you can have an income tax is if it is applied to every person in the state universally. So if it's a 5% income tax.
That's not what the constitution says, actually.
Well, yeah.
It says that if it has to be a flat uniform rate. So I just want to make sure that we're speaking in the actual constitution. You said if it applies to everybody in the state. That's not what uniformity is. If it applies to everybody that has income and it is taxed uniformly.
It has to be the same rate on everybody. You cannot have a graduated
same rate. Precisely. You hit it on it. So yes, it is a flat rate. So here's the thing. I again reject your assertion that this is the holy grail. Progressive taxation, it's not about any one policy solution, Dori. It's about we want a tax code that does not disproportionately rely on low and middle income households and small startup and low margin businesses. There's no one policy that actually, you know, is like, ooh, that's what we need. Honestly, like the reason I'm putting the wealth tax forward is there is so much accumulated wealth in this world.
I believe that's a problem. I'm with you on that, Noelle. I do see the problem there. But
I'm glad.
But they're going to move. They're going to avoid it. And I just would believe this much more if when you already have a 9% increase in the budget, I don't know why there aren't bills introduced that would just cut the taxes on the working class. And you guys say we'll live within we'll reduce our rate of spending a tiny bit less. And we'll start cutting the taxes for the working people. Then I'd believe the sincerity of this.
So, Dori, I continue to push back on your assertion that, well, people will just move. I will just say, you know, the one tax that we have on the books that begins to get at wealth is the estate tax. And as you know, Paul Allen passed away in the last year, and we just lost Bill Gates Sr., who, again, was an incredible champion for progressive tax reform. Dori, either one of those men could have up and moved from the state to avoid the estate tax before they passed, and they did not. And so I just firmly reject the cynical view of the world that these folks are only making decisions based on taxes. We know, and there's great research on this. I encourage folks to go take a look at The Myth of Millionaire Flight by Christobal Young that talks about what actually drives decision making for wealthy people. And the argument, the conclusion of this is, you know, they're really about putting down roots, building in community, well, and the amenities that keep them here. And let me finish, Tori, because you've asked a lot of questions and not given me a chance.
Yeah, I've given you 80% of the conversation. My point is, we have reality of what's happened in Europe. They had to cancel the wealth tax because everybody moved. So the theory
my
of a book
that, I don't
doesn't,
have it in front of me, but I think their rate was much higher than the 1% that we're talking about. I don't have that in front of me, but that is my recollection. So we're talking
also
about
on only
a
millionaires.
1%.
It was on millionaires. You're talking about on billionaires, and 1% of somebody who's got $100 billion is $1 billion. They're not going to write $1 billion check to the Washington
you do
State
not
Treasury.
Know that, sir. I encourage you to get a billionaire on your line and see if you can corroborate your assertion. But I firmly reject
it. In all seriousness, why don't you just call up those, you know, 4 or 8 or 12 people and just ask them for the good. If they're so willing to do this, why don't you just ask them instead of codifying this with law and say, hey, would you guys write $1 billion check to us every year?
You got
it,
Dory.
And we'll do a lot of wonderful things with it.
This is, I mean, I totally get that this is a different philosophical view on the role of government. And you and I are not going to agree on that. I mean, like I said before, philanthropy is an amazing, wonderful thing, and we're grateful for it. But it does not replace the core functions of government and sharing equitably in that responsibility of funding community investments. So many of these folks are already doing incredible work on philanthropy, and they at the same time are advocating for progressive taxation so that everybody's sharing equitably in that responsibility of funding community investments. And when it comes to our property tax, the property tax in this state is specifically dedicated to funding of our common schools and upholding our paramount duty of the state to provide for basic education of our students.
And they're doing a bang up job with all that money, aren't they?
I think we've made a lot of strides.
We're not going to agree on too much. But, okay, look, we're way out of time.
You and I grew up in the state, and we're doing okay, are we not? I mean, come on. So I think that we're doing pretty well. And what I am asking is that we have equity and parity in the tax code, and I hope people will take a serious look at this proposal as a tool of comprehensive structural tax.
Here's what I love. I love people like you who are willing to come on and spar with me on issues that everybody's talking about. I really love that, and I really appreciate you doing this.
I appreciate the invitation very much, and happy to come back anytime as the proposal progresses.
Let's do it again. Okay. All right. Representative Noelle Frame, sponsor of this wealth tax in Olympia. Noelle, thanks for coming on. Appreciate it.
Thanks. Have a great rest of your day.
Subaru Studio. Welcome! Welcome to the big show. It's a holiday. It's President's Day. And as you know, nobody is more thrilled at the presidents we've had. I mean, come on, Joe Biden, Donald Trump, Barack Obama, George W. Bush. Who could be more thrilled with the array of presidents that we've had? And so, I am going to celebrate our fortune today with these great presidents. I'm going to take a day, I'm going to sit under a tree, I'm going to look up at the sky, and I'm just going to be thankful at the fantastic leaders that we've had. So, the only way I can get the afternoon free is by doing a best of show. So we are going to reflect back on some of our favorite segments, some of our favorite interviews from the last couple of weeks. We present them for you here, and then I will see you back before you know it with a live show. But enjoy this very special holiday edition of the Dory Monson Show. Well, Seattle and really Portland have been ground zero for the worst of the rioting in America over the last year. Antifa has been behind it. And, you know, I started tracking the Antifa movement a few years ago when Kasham Sawant revealed who was controlling her on the Seattle City Council. And the socialist Marxist group that she is a part of, they have a very explicit goal, and that is to tear down cities from within, to destroy them, and then to rebuild in a Marxist image. And a lot of people thought, well, this will get a lot better once Joe Biden's elected. And it has not gotten better, because this is not about liberal versus conservative. It's not about Democrat versus Republican. But it's my contention that this is about Marxism versus capitalism. There is somebody who is far more learned than I on all of these issues. Andy Ngo is the New York Times best-selling author. He is the author of a brand new book called Unmasked: Inside Antifa's Radical Plan to Destroy Democracy. And Andy joins us once again here on the Dory Monson Show. Andy, it's always great to talk with you.
Thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. Let's start with just the subtitle of your book, Inside Antifa's Radical Plan to Destroy Democracy. As I said, I've been saying for years that this is about Marxism versus capitalism. Is that what you believe to be true as well?
That's part of the story, but I think it's actually something bigger. I think it's more about anarchy, anarchist communism in particular, versus the American philosophy. So the whole agenda of the Antifa political movement is to destroy the nation states around the world because they don't recognize any governments. But they view the United States as the main enemy. And that's because the United States has been a force for exporting liberal democracy around the world, property protection rights, freedom of expression, the rule of law. All of that is anathema to their worldview. So they believe that they can that they must destroy the republic and from its ashes, and that's their words, build a utopia. And it's very grand and theoretical, but then you can look at what happens when they put their plan into action. So last year, for more than 3 weeks, for example, in Seattle, they had taken city property near downtown and claimed it to be an autonomous zone, not under American jurisdiction.
Right.
And they set up a hard border, and they had that border manned by their armed militias. And the city allowed that to happen because they believed that these people were doing it in the name of social justice. And inside, they were radicalizing people with extremist literature. Within days, it devolved into violence, shootings, and then murders.
Well, and so what is their motivation, Andy? Why are they hell-bent on destroying America?
Because they believe, so when they say they're anti-fascist, when you dive into their ideology, as I write in the book, they remake words and concepts to have completely different meanings from how people understand it, how academics understand. So they don't refer to fascism as just a far-right political ideology that was represented in movements like the National Socialists in Germany or Fascist Party in Italy. They define it really to be anything that is opposed to their political worldview. So they view the United States as a fascist imperialistic state. They view capitalism, property rights, freedom of expression as vectors for fascism to be spread. So if you go back a few years and think about what they were doing before they were burning down neighborhoods and cities and seizing territories and buildings, they were involved in political brawls in the streets. Portland was particularly brutal. That's my hometown.
Right.
And it was there that they were able to carry out acts of violence against other citizens. And they were saying that it was bashing the fascists, punching Nazis. And the response from the mainstream left was to legitimize those actions. They thought it was appropriate response to use violence in opposition to somebody's speech or thought.
It's been very disturbing to see how the media covered this over the last year. And it was because they were almost afraid that speaking out against Antifa would somehow be perceived as being against social justice. And I mean, when you have all these powerful forces, when you have people in the streets willing to commit acts of violence, when you have feckless leaders like Ted Wheeler in Portland and Jenny Durkin in Seattle, when you have a media that is afraid to really stand up against all of this destruction, both physical and ideological, that's a pretty powerful concept for the average person to have to battle against when you have all these forces lined up against people who are just wanting to protect our way of life.
That's right. I'm really glad you brought up all those different variables. So one reason, one question I got asked a lot is, why does it seem like Antifa is a big force now? And that perception of it being like a new phenomenon is not off. Antifa as a movement has been around for a few decades, but it previously was on the fringes of the far left. They were able to move right into the center of the mainstream left because of all the things you just said. So they had support through useful idiots in the media, as well as fellow travelers and sympathizers, and even members who work as journalists. They have the support of the culture. They have the support of foolish politicians like the mayor of Portland, mayor of Seattle, and even some governors as well. And so all of that brought together created this sort of perfect conditions that allowed for them to continue to grow and to recruit and to embed and make their violence more sophisticated, which is why incrementally through each year from 2016 all the way to 2020, each year it got progressively worse. And then 2020 was when they really showed what they were capable of, which in the example of Portland, that was more than 120 days of recurring violence. And by violence, I'm talking about people setting fires to buildings where people are inside, setting fires to police stations, bringing homemade explosives to the riots and guns and knives, creating no-go zones. And eventually they shot and killed somebody, hunted down a Trump supporter, one of their Antifa security. Michael Rhino, I write about how deadly Antifa actually are.
That was on the streets of Portland. We're talking with Andy Ngo. His book is Unmasked, Inside Antifa's Radical Plan to Destroy Democracy. And he's going to spend another segment with us here, talk about why Seattle, why Portland, why have we become ground zero. Our conversation with Andy Ngo continues in just a moment here on The Dory Monson Show. All right, I'm back with Andy Ngo. His new book is Unmasked, Inside Antifa's Radical Plan to Destroy Democracy. Andy, you're a little bit younger than me. I grew up here in Seattle. You grew up in Portland. My wife grew up right across the river from Portland in Vancouver, Washington. These were places that valued independence, independent thought, hard work. How have Portland and Seattle become ground zero for this absolutely destructive force that is Antifa?
Well, it's nice to be speaking to somebody from the Pacific Northwest, because when I'm describing the conditions for what's happening on the ground, people in D.C. and New York, there's a lot of disbelief.
Yeah. But, so you're right.
To answer your question, why in particular these cities in the Pacific Northwest? Well, the reason is that these areas are political monocultures. And both Seattle and Portland and some other cities in the Pacific Northwest have had a long history of progressive politics. It's part of the culture. A lot of the people there live alternative and or you could view as weird lifestyles just for the sake of it. So it was always counterculture. And I think that provided kind of a really perfect breeding ground for these extremist movements to take root in these areas, because there was really no, there was no opposition from the center right, or there's really no Republican presence in any meaningful way in Portland or Seattle. You know, they're not, they have no political power, and they're not, those who are elected to in office, either in city council or as a mayor, they have no need to moderate. They're always pushed more and more to the left. So in 2016, with the election of Donald Trump and the universal hatred of the federal, the former federal administration and the former president from those who were duly elected to represent citizens, they turned a blind eye to far left extremism. They actually believed Antifa were, quote, anti-fascist, and they believed that Trump was a fascistic president that needed to be resisted.
And you had Joe Biden, who said Antifa is just an idea and denied that it was even a real force. So let me ask you, we only have a couple minutes left. Why have you, you're a very smart guy. You could have done anything with your life. You put yourself in harm's way. People have seen your Twitter account where you are in the middle of this. You are hated, and hated to the point where there's some who want you dead. Why have you chosen to make this your life's work? Why do you have such passion for fighting against this?
Yeah, Antifa has actually tried to kill me before. They beat me severely in 2019 in downtown Portland, and I was hospitalized with a brain hemorrhage as a result. And they've continued ever since then to try to finish what they started. I do what I do because I'm not the only one who's been victimized by these terrorists. There's been countless of other people, and the majority of them have absolutely no voice and no way to get their story out. I'm very privileged in that, you know, I get interviewed. I'm speaking with you now. I have a book out. I have a large following on social media. I get published in big newspapers. That is a privilege that I want to use to make sure that I'm fighting for justice for other people, people who report their instances of being assaulted to police and nothing ever happens. The media ignores what happens to them. So that's why I do what I do. And it does come at a heavy cost, as you said. And for that reason, unfortunately, I've had to, at least for the moment, leave my hometown in Portland. Just there were all these escalating threats against me, and people were showing up to my home, and the police did nothing.
Note that Andy is out of the country as he does this interview, in part because of threats that he's received. So in the 30 seconds we have remaining, what's the end game? What's the end game for our cities that have been taken over by these clowns?
You know, I wish I could be optimistic, but I think the present and near future will be bleak, because all of the variables that allowed the Antifa to grow are still there. Their opposition to Trump was always pretextual. It doesn't really matter that he's not in office anymore. They're going to continue to try to destabilize the areas as they have done since Election Day in November.
It's very scary stuff. It's a great book. It's the most important book of the new year thus far. Unmasked, Inside Antifa's Radical Plan to Destroy Democracy. Everybody in the country's reading it. It's a bestseller, but it is particularly relevant for those of us here in the Pacific Northwest. Andy has done a great job of chronicling how this group has destroyed once great cities. Andy, I wish you nothing but the best. I wish you safety going forward, and I'll look forward to talking to you again about this sometime soon.
Thank you.
Citizen journalist Andy Ngo joining us. The book is Unmasked, and it's a great read. It's a disturbing read, but it's a great read. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can text me at 98973. That's 98973. Lots more to come here in the Dory Monson Show. We'll be right back.
I going to work there much longer? No, I'm not going to work there. I'm a driver. I'm a winner. Things are going to change. I can feel it.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. You're really a fantastic audience.